You're listening to Knowing Faith, a podcast of Training the Church.
This is Kyle Worley, and I'm joined by my co-hosts JT English and Jen Wilkin.
Hey, Kyle. I was just thinking, Kyle asked me right before we started to do the introduction, and now I'm just lost. I thought about it, and now I don't even know how to say hello anymore.
Well, what do other people do at the beginning of their podcasts? I feel like every time it's just awkward and goofy for us.
Guys.
No, it's basically every podcast except for like the really, really professional ones. They feel like a cold open.
We're a really, really professional one.
Yeah, some of us are more professional than others. I think that if professionalism was a spectrum, Jen would be high on the list. You and me, JT, would be fighting for the dead last position on the podcast based off of the battles we have fought in the past. Well, today, and the audience would not know how other podcasts start because we are their first love. So, right. Thank you, Knowing Faith audience. Hey, no, you know what? This is a great moment because we're talking about, let me just say this. Hey, thank you for listening to Knowing Faith. A lot of you have left reviews on iTunes for the podcast. You're following us on social media. You're sharing what we're doing. Thank you. We don't say that enough. We are really honored. Jen, you were saying that you just came from a conference and you were hearing from a lot of people that they've really enjoyed the show.
Yeah, but you know what else I'm hearing? And I'm a little torqued about this. Like, what season are we in?
Ooh, six.
Yeah. Season six, and I still do not have a Crickleback t-shirt.
Oof. Yep. That's true.
Like, what do I have to do to get a Crickleback t-shirt?
You know what? That's a good point. If there's somebody out there, if there's an enterprising Knowing Faith listener that wants to design a legitimate Crickleback shirt, then we will wear them and take pictures of ourselves wearing them.
Do you have the It's Bananas mug?
I did. Yeah. I was sent one of those. My one that says, what was the other? It says, the Bible is for everyone. Mm-hmm. It arrived with the handle snapped off. I didn't want to tell you.
But now you can
until
just
we
use
were
it
recording.
As yeah. Okay. It fits into your. Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you. So this is that was a great plug for our.
our quality stuff here.
We're professionalism.
Yeah, we're like, Jen's like, make sure you go buy one of our mugs. Mine came broken.
Get you some
gashed
broken
my
stuff.
Hand open.
Yeah. Well, but was it broken butthole though?
Oh man. Hey, that doesn't count as one of mine.
That's another t-shirt.
Yeah, well.
Another t-shirt idea, but please don't design that.
I'm waiting. Yeah. I'm waiting until we hit our inevitable plateau, and then we'll start releasing the broken butthole merchandise. Mm-hmm. And that'll be our second wind.
Mm-hmm. Oh no.
Oh my goodness.
But Kyle, seriously, listeners, go Google Mosaic Church logo and tell me that Kyle did not design a logo that looks like his tagline.
Kyle, you're going to have to change the logo.
People of Mosaic Church that listen to this podcast, let me encourage you. The last shall be first and the first shall be last. You know what I'm saying?
But if that's true and you're the last, you're going to be first. Doesn't that make you laugh?
I know, right? It's like
Inception.
I was about to quote the funniest meme I'd seen in a long time, but I'm not going to do that. Okay.
Hey, we have a last being first story today.
Bang. There we go. Oh. Perfect segue. We've been exploring Genesis 12 through 50 this season on Knowing Faith. Today we find ourselves in the middle of really of the story of Joseph, but it's kind of a detour. Like Joseph's story, we kick into Joseph's story. He gets sold. He's headed towards Egypt with the Midianite caravan. He's going to be sold to Potiphar at Potiphar's house. And then about the moment we're hearing that Joseph has wound up there, it says it happened. It's almost like this transitional phrase. Yeah. Meanwhile, .. And you know, in other news, it happened at that time that Judah, one of Joseph's brothers, went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain, Adullamite.
Mine says Canaanite.
Really? Mine says Adullamite.
Oh, certain. I'm sorry. I was looking down below.
whose name was Hira. There, Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son. He called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Yet again, she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Judah was in Chezeb when she bore him, and Judah took a wife for Ur, for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar.
Tamar. Hey, quick show of hands. How many of you have heard a sermon over the chapter that we are currently going through? Kyle is raising his hand.
Yeah, on this audio medium, you can't see me, but my hand is up.
I don't think I have, honestly.
Yeah, because people don't want to talk about this because it's super awkward.
Yeah, it is. This story is a tricky one to navigate well. And so, but we're going to jump into it. Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Okay, so Tamar has been given over to Judah's firstborn son, mm-hmm. Ur. And Ur is such a bad dude that God kills him.
Right.
Strikes him dead. Then it says this, then Judah said to Onan, this is Ur's brother, okay? Mm-hmm. Go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother. Now, can we just pause right here for a second?
Yeah.
Is this conventional or unconventional what's happening here? Because when somebody hears this, they might go, whoa, hold on. What's going on here? But this was actually Judah trying, at least it looks like, to practice a custom that was meant for good for people.
Yeah, right? he's actually at this point in the story trying to do the right thing. So Ur is so bad that God kills him. So just for a moment, think about the significance for Tamar in that. She's been married to a guy who is so terrible that God strikes him dead. And so now we find out that actually Judah's other son is really no better than the first, because when he is told to go and do what he is asked to do, basically legally, which is to provide offspring in the marriage that would functionally be the firstborn of his dead brother. That this is called levirate marriage. And in this manner, the line is preserved. He refuses to do it. And he refuses to do it because effectively what would happen is the rights, the inheritance of his brother would go not to him because his brother's not dead, but would instead go to the child that he fathers with Tamar.
Yeah, and his refusal is interesting. And I just want to acknowledge that it is the next verses here are just kind of weird. Mm-hmm. And I just put cards on the table. We've had to record this part a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. Well, more like four.
Because the strangeness of the manner of Onan's refusal can be a little bit funny to read. I'm not going to read it because I'm fearful that once again, I will break it by laughing. And it is, Onan is not actually doing a funny thing. Onan is doing a wicked thing.
Mm-hmm. It's denounced. And, you know, this is significant because, so basically he decides that rather than make this a fruitful union, he is going to, in a very secretive way, prevent Tamar from ever being able to conceive. So of course Tamar would know, but no one outside of the marriage would necessarily know what's going on. But we get this this editorializing that is really uncommon in the text. And we saw it actually in the story of Dinah. It said that what happened to her was wicked. But then we see in verse 10, it says, what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord. And so the Lord puts him to death too.
Yeah, because he would not provide children. He wouldn't do the righteous mm-hmm. and honorable thing. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, this provision of children is both the continuation of the line. That's the theological thing that's running through here. But it is also a way of continuing to manage and provide sustainability for households. Yes. That Tamar was not just going to be included in the potential line of the chosen and promised offspring, but that the provision of children was an economic and civic and organizational safety net for mm-hmm. her own provision and protection.
That's right. It's good for the community, but it is certainly good for Tamar, you know, as absolutely. A widow. I mean, widows don't fare well in this culture, generally speaking.
Yeah, so when Onan withholds himself and withholds the offspring and his seed, this is not just a theological problem, or it's not just a theological or blasphemous thing. It's a disrespectful, undignified, unrighteous way of behaving towards Tamar. Now, that feels strange to us, but it would not have been strange to them. And I think this is just one of those areas where you have to realize that there's an imaginative gap oftentimes for us that exists between us and the world of the ancient Near East.
Well, and what we miss is the tone of the story that has already been set is look at Tamar, the victim. I mean, that really is the way that the story is being set up, is that Tamar is becoming increasingly more and more victimized by this particular family. And since we miss that piece, the rest of the story makes us often paint Tamar in a light that is actually not something she deserves. And also, I would just like to point out, JT, you have not said one word. You're just sitting there super quiet, like you aren't the reason we had to record things four times.
I am not. Jen, you can be honest right now. You have the opportunity to be honest with the listeners. Why did we have to record again?
I did misspeak in the first run that we took at it.
No one will ever know.
You guys didn't even catch it.
It's true. That'll be released on our Knowing Faith B-sides one day. Well, what Onan did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up, for he feared that he would die like his brother. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers. He and his friend Hira, the Adullamite, we've already met Hira earlier on in the story. And when Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up. She sat at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown up and she had not been given him in a marriage. So basically, a lot of years have transpired because Judah said, hey, I've got another son. I'm going to do right by you when he's old enough. And this is telling us now.
Well, he never intended to. It's already been said, you know, he was afraid. He thinks she's a black widow. He basically thinks that anybody he marries to her is going to die.
Yeah. And not that his sons are just messed up.
Yeah. Are so terrible that the Lord has to kill them.
Right. So she goes up because she now realizes Judah is not going to do the righteous thing here. Mm-hmm. He has failed to do that. He is failing to do that. And he has lied to me. Go ahead.
Can I just say one more thing, Kyle? I'm sorry. But like, if you think about, she has just had two unspeakably bad marriages in this family. And yet she still is going to contend for a third marriage. What are the odds that this third son is going to be better than the first two? And I think that's an important detail for us because it throws into sharp relief how desperate her situation is as a widow living in her father's house, that she would think it was preferable to be married to the third son of Judah after everything she's gone through tells us the pressures that she's up against as a widow in the society who's been sent back to be a burden to her family of origin.
Absolutely. So she goes and she sits at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown up and she had not been given him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said, come, let me come into you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, what will you give me that you may come into me? He answered, I will send you a young goat from the flock. And she said, if you give me a pledge until you send it. He said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her. He went into her and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. So Judah sleeps with Tamar, who is not his daughter by blood, but is his daughter-in-law, who has been married now to two, or has been married to one of his sons, given to the second son, who did not do right by her, and both were killed. And the third, who he promised to give to her, he did not. Now Judah has conceived a child with Tamar. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, that one's a hard one.
We got to back up.
Okay.
Because I need you to see what's going on here with Judah. Notice how the text reads. It doesn't say that she called out to him to come into her.
Right.
It says that he says, come, let me come into you. So basically what's being intimated to us is that this is his habit.
Yeah.
And she knows apparently that all she has to do is make herself available and he will show up and he will take the, he will initiate everything, which just goes to show you the quality of family that you're dealing with that has produced these three bad apples of sons.
Yeah. And why are you making it a point to talk about the fact that he's the one that called out to her? Because you're doing that for a reason. Right.
Well, because we're going to find out he's going to actually pronounce a verdict on her later that we often withhold from her. Mm-hmm. And when he says he's going to send her a young goat from the flock, she says, no, that's not what I want. She says she wants his, she says, I need a pledge that you'll send it. And she asks for his signet, his cord, and his staff, which is basically his wallet, his keys, and his driver's license. Like she can identify him with those items.
We live in a possession and money-obsessed culture, but what does the Bible say about generosity? In his new book, A Short Guide to Gospel Generosity, author Nathan Harris shows us that the answer to our obsession with possessions is turning to the gospel, because only in the gospel can we find the type of life transformation that enables us to turn our focus from ourselves and back to others, to give generously, and to follow in the way of Christ. To learn more about the book, visit guidetogospelgenerosity.com. That's guidetogospelgenerosity.com. The CSB Life Counsel Bible provides biblical counsel and practical wisdom for pastors, ministry leaders, counselors, parents, couples, and any individual seeking practical wisdom through the application of God's Word. It includes more than 150 full-length articles on a wide range of topics and tough issues from respected Christian counselors and scholars. Visit CSBLifeCounselBible.com to get your copy today. Visit CSBLifeCounselBible.com to get your copy today.
So the story goes on, and it says that Judas sends the young goat, and he asks them in the place, where's the cult prostitute who was at NM at the roadside? They said, no cult prostitute has been here. So he returned to Judah and said, I have not found her. Also, the men of the place said, no cult prostitute has been here. And Judah replied, let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her. Okay, so now Judah's realizing, I have made it, like something has happened here. I've been tricked. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be foolish if this gets found out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's realizing that there's going to be consequences to his sin. But I think something that it's maybe hard for us in a secular West to realize in a hypersexualized moment, Judas not just thinking he participated in a sexual act, he participated in what he considers to be cult prostitution. Like he is tying mm-hmm. himself to other religious bodies via a sexual act. So in the ancient Near Eastern world, there was no such thing as just believing you were participating in prostitution as a sexual act. For him, mm-hmm. this is a deeply religious act, which gives you a picture of his relationship with the Lord, of his understanding of God's covenantal promises, even the sign of circumcision that is on him and how he's using that sign to participate in other religious bodies. That's something that we should see here. And he's not worried about that at this point. He's only worried mm-hmm. about the consequences of his sin, that I might be embarrassed. I shouldn't have done this because of the consequences it could have for me socially.
Right.
And that's a pretty significant point, I think.
Well, and then you, again, think about it from Tamar's perspective. Not only has she been willing to advocate for a marriage to a third son who's probably a jerk, but she's willing to do this in a way that is costly. Like, it's mm-hmm. not like she's excited at the prospect of sleeping with this old dude, basically. She is desperate. And she is also, as we'll see, doing the righteous thing. I'll just save that for just a little bit. Keep going.
Got it. So this is what happens. About 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law has been immoral. Moreover, she's pregnant by immorality. Okay. And what is Judah's reaction? Bring her out and let her be burned.
Super mm-hmm. religious thing to do, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, do you ever notice that the people who are sometimes often most ingrained in their own sin want the gravest consequences for others who they perceive to be sinners?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's why I think when the moral failings of some of these huge evangelical pastors, mm-hmm. when it comes out and it's like, well, but like, didn't you rail against this?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, shamed people shame people, right?
Yeah. And often it's the sin that you are most against is the one you most struggle with, or the sin that you want to see perceived or be judged is something that you actually have a deeply ingrained habit or sin struggle against yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not always, but just obviously we see that here.
Mm-hmm. It says, as she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, "By the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant." And she said, "Please identify whose these are, the signet, and the cord and the staff." Then Judah identified them and said, "She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son, Shelah." And he did not know her again. Mm-hmm. So this is a huge moment because in one event, he moves from she's done something wrong, burn her, mm-hmm. to she's more righteous than I am.
Mm-hmm. And so this is one of those stories. This is an idea I've been exploring a little bit, and I just had an opportunity to teach on it just a few days ago. It's a motif that you see elsewhere in the scriptures, but it's important for us to pay attention to Tamar in particular because she is the first of the five women who is mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew. And often the genealogy is taught, the women in the genealogy are presented to us as sexually immoral or question of questionable motive, with regard to some sexual encounter, who are in the genealogy to show us that God will work through even someone like Tamar.
Right.
But what the text is showing us here is that she is a righteous person. And not only that, but she is a Canaanite. She's outside of the line. And so she is someone who is able to show us in the genealogy how the Gentiles are included in the promises that come to us through Christ. But she's presented to us not as an unrighteous member of the genealogy, or certainly not any more unrighteous than some of the other people that we find in the genealogy. And in this particular story that is really all that we know about her, she is given to us as someone who contends for the righteous line to go forward. And she fits a motif that is started in the garden called woman against the serpent. And that's, that the there will be enmity between the woman and the serpent, and then the prophecy that the serpent would bruise the offspring's heel, but he would crush its head. And you see this motif elsewhere in the Bible where there is a woman who, or women, if you look at the Hebrew midwives and some others, who basically shake their fist at the one who is wielding power in a way that is meant to kill life, and say, "I stand up for the rights of the line of the children of God." And so that's what the Hebrew midwives do. It's what Rahab ends up doing in some sense. And often in the stories of these women, as we see here with Tamar, there's deception on the part of the woman. And that's the thing I think that's most fascinating to me is that we all know that the serpent himself is the original deceiver. And so we see Tamar and these other women employing the serpent's own weapons and turning them against him. You might say, in New Testament terms, that we see her being as shrewd as a serpent, all the while being as innocent as a dove.
Hmm. Man. Yep. That is really good.
Is this when we just stop?
Well, no, but I think it's pivotal because you're right, Jen. Raise your hand if you've heard a sermon preached about the genealogy of Jesus, uh-huh. where the women were featured as basically mm-hmm. these grimy, filthy people. Mm-hmm. God can use anybody, right?
Well, it's tough. I mean, we covered this a lot when we talked about, First and Second Samuel, the Bathsheba. The thing that's so disturbing is that so often the person in the narrative who figures in the role of the serpent, who is conformed to the image of the serpent, is someone who we want to see as the hero of the story. And so with the case of David in that story of Bathsheba, he's the one who comes to kill, steal, and destroy. And then Bathsheba stands up for the rights of her son Solomon to sit on the throne. But that's a hard, it's hard for us to get there because we're so accustomed to hearing David is the hero, Judah, he's the one who we know, Jesus is going to come through this line. And so we want to find a way to make Judah the hero of the story. And that's not to say that because they conform to the image of the serpent at that point in the story, that they are evil. They are acting in ways that are in accordance with that, with the wrong image. But it's to serve the further point that the serpent is still making war against the woman all the way through.
Yep. That is good. Thank you, when the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on the hand, saying, this one came out first. But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out. Huh, does this sound familiar? And he said, what a breach you have made for yourself. Therefore, his name was called Perez. Afterward, his brother came out with a scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. So this story sounds real familiar, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Who does this sound like, listeners? It sounds like Jacob and Esau, mm-hmm. right? I think that's fascinating. Genesis is full of these resonances where mm-hmm. these stories have like some echo to them.
Mm-hmm. Last shall be first moments.
Yeah.
Where the second son becomes the first son. And even in the case of Tamar, you know, she's someone that we would assign to the last, and yet she ends up being elevated. She's in the genealogy of Christ, and she's proclaimed righteous. So yeah, pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. It's pretty cool. And this is where we're going to end today. Is there any concluding thoughts we have on the story of Judah and Tamar before we jump into Joseph in Egypt? Because this is kind of an interesting excursus, and we haven't broached this question, but like maybe this is a great place to land. This seems, and Genesis does this, and narratives do this occasionally. This is kind of it's a departure. We were hearing about Joseph. Mm-hmm. Judah factored into that story, but not as like an A-list character, right? I mean, he was the star of Genesis 37 is Joseph. But in 38, now we're talking about Judah and Tamar. Mm-hmm. Why? I mean, is there any reason other than to just tell the story of Israel to explain the origin of Zerah and Perez? The continuation of the line? I mean, all those would be unique contributions of this story, but gosh, they fall right in the middle, or not right in the middle, but like the Joseph story is starting and then we cut away immediately. And I don't know that I know why.
Yeah, I think you just hinted at it right there. One of the major promises throughout this story that Jen's already highlighted, Genesis 3:15, that there will be an offspring that comes to crush the head of the serpent. And we're continually thinking the whole way, who is this mm-hmm. going to be? Is it going to be Abraham? Is it going to be Isaac? Is it going to be Jacob? Is it going to be Simeon? Is it going to be Reuben? Is it going to be Judah? Is it going to be Joseph? And here we're seeing that through this birth of Perez, ultimately there's going to be one who comes, and you're going to think, is it going to be him? So one of the questions that you should be asking, not every time you read Genesis, but one of the main questions it's asking is, how is this offspring going to be perpetuated, propagated, and which offspring will be the one who ultimately comes to be the king? Mm-hmm. And again, it's coming in this first shall be last way, last shall be first, this way that is incredibly unpredictable, that God is going to bring about his redemptive purposes.
Yeah. And I think a good exercise in terms of building Bible literacy with this is, because we hit chapter 38, and like we know when we hear that Joseph is going into Potiphar's house, we're thinking of like every vacation Bible school we ever went to where you learn the story of Joseph and what's going to happen there. And we don't want the story to cut away to this story. Also, the story is so awkward that, you know, your three hosts couldn't even get through it without having a seventh grade moment laughing, right? And so it's like you just want to cut this out. And so the question we always have to ask is, why isn't it cut out? Like,
right.
What is the story missing if chapter 38 isn't in Genesis? And it's in there because it's refocusing us on who is going to be a critical figure in the narrative, and that's Judah. And Judah is going to figure in a big way into the story of Joseph, and obviously figures in a big way into the line that's going to go forward.
That's good. And yet the story is going to continue, and it's going to continue back, not with Judah, but with Joseph in Egypt. And so on our next episode, we will rejoin Joseph. We will find him in Potiphar's house, and we'll continue to explore that story as we look for connections to the greater story of Jesus Christ. You can join the conversation by finding us on social media. We're at Knowing Faith Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/knowingfaithpodcast for some cool exclusive stuff over there for our patrons. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy the discussion. Grace and peace.